Kultur denken, der Podcast des IFK Wien. Liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, willkommen zum IFK Podcast. Mein Name ist Martin Gastaner. In dieser Folge der Season 2 Messy Beginnings habe ich die Philosophin Alexis Shotwell zu einem Gespräch gebeten. Unser Gespräch kreiste um das faszinierende Konzept der Messy Beginnings, der unordentlichen Anfänge. Shotwell, deren Arbeit Philosophie und praktischen Aktivismus verbindet, bietet einen einzigartigen Blick auf die Komplexität von Anfängen von Wissenschaft, Kunst und sozialen Bewegungen. Ihre Gedanken fordern uns heraus, unseren gewohnten Vorstellungen von Ursprüngen und Neuanfängen zu überdenken. In unserem Gespräch erkunden wir, wie Shotwells Erfahrungen im AIDS-Aktivismus ihre philosophischen Überlegungen beeinflusst haben. Wir diskutieren ihr Konzept des Implicit Understanding und dessen Bedeutung für unser Verständnis von kollektivem Wissen und gesellschaftlichem Wandel. Darüber hinaus betrachten wir, wie Shotwells Ideen uns helfen können, aktuelle Herausforderungen anzugehen. Wie können wir in Krisenzeiten neue Wege finden? Wie lernen wir aus der Vergangenheit, ohne uns von ihr einschränken zu lassen? Ich lade Sie ein, uns auf dieser gedanklichen Reise zu begleiten. Lassen Sie uns gemeinsam die Bedeutung und das Potenzial unordentlicher Anfänge entdecken.
In my, previous life before, well, and also when I was an academic, I did a lot of radio and a lot of,
you did?
Yeah, like a lot of, in the US we have pirate radio, so radio yeah. That doesn't have an official, so I spent a lot of time with headphones like this, yeah.
And what kind of topics did you
do? Mostly I did feminist radio, yeah, so we did, it was like pre-podcasts, but we
and
did
and pre-academic for you?
Yeah, for me this was like I started in high school and then I went, super. You know, through.
Yeah, the high school radio is something yeah. of like a yeah. metaphor as well yeah, in these new movies as well.
That's right, yeah.
And in Canada?
Yeah, I mean, so in Canada it's more, there's like little community radio stations. In the US it was, yeah, unlicensed. There was a station where I was in grad school called Pirate Radio Santa Cruz that was a really
Santa Cruz.
Yeah, so long-standing.
This is California then?
Yeah, in California, yeah. That's where I did. My family moved to Nova Scotia in Canada.
Okay.
And then I went back to the US for graduate school and then came back to Canada for my jobs. Yeah.
Yeah, to have a prof.
Yeah, yeah, now. Yeah, yeah.
And you have developed this radio program as well to oral history, I read.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, yeah, that was an amazing process too. Yeah, it was that started because I was friends with someone who'd been an AIDS activist in the Canadian yeah. context, and I had a lover in New York who was working on the New York AIDS activist history, and there just had never been anything like that in Canada. No one was collecting the stories, and so we did it, and partially, like we spent 7 years and had to run out of money, and so yeah. now it's mostly just an archive, but it was an amazing Yeah, amazing time talking to people and hearing what they'd done.
Also survivors or yeah. families of them?
Yeah, so mostly people, we focused entirely on people who had been activists, so
right.
who had worked in groups. And so that was a combination of people who were living with HIV then and had lived, and then people who were HIV negative then but were working on it. And so, yeah, some of it, like thinking about this, what comes in the aftermath was about, yeah, how people carry on when, you know, when the struggle changes or when you've lost a lot of people, you know. And it's so interesting to think about these things because the way that we remember and what we can remember is so shaped by what people have done, right? So in that case, there was a period of time before HIV was defined the way that it's defined now. And this is hard to remember, right? So now the definition of when you have AIDS, when you have HIV, includes things like T cell counts and certain kinds of opportunistic infections. But then it didn't. It was defined entirely through a sort of like young man body. And so So one of the slogans from the activist campaign that changed the definition of AIDS was, women don't get AIDS, they just die of it.
Yeah.
Because all of the diagnostic criteria that were specific to bodies with uteruses and vaginas, like having, you know, pervasive, really intense candida infections, yeast infections, these were not part of the criteria, but they were definitely one of the things that would tell you that someone was having a lot of opportunistic infections. So men would get thrush infections in their throats more. So things like that. But then also these very basic diagnostic criteria, which came along with technological transformations. So being able to identify T cells and know when your T cell count was really low. That was all something that happened in history. And so the other thing that I loved about learning about that history, learning about that activism, was that it was also a way to understand how the fights of the past are still present in our life. My co-investigator for that project, Gary Kinsman, he talks about it as unforgetting. And he calls it the struggle to remember the past for the future. So that if you forget that all of these things that now help people were something that someone won, right?
Okay.
You can begin to feel like, oh, you know, the government just did a nice thing for people because it cared. And there were individuals who care, right? But in fact, what happened was that people collectively made a different world that we live in now. And so especially when things have gotten better, it's hard to remember that sometimes.
Okay. So the construction process is in the middle. And this is your work, I think, in academics as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I was wondering, activist work and academic work, where are the bridges between practical and theoretical work? We are in this kind of exhibition now, dealing exactly with this.
Yeah.
So how did you transform your ideas you get as an activist for this AIDS remembrance into your academic studies and into your kind of very distinct philosophy?
Mm. So I think for me, it actually came earlier. And it was really, I was a undergraduate in the philosophy department in McGill University in Montreal, Canada. And I was studying with a philosopher named Charles Taylor, who I don't agree with about many things, but was a brilliant, amazing teacher and really like quite an honor to study with him as an undergrad. And I took a class with him, a seminar class with him about Wittgenstein, Ludwig Wittgenstein. And I had been really interested in Wittgenstein as a, you know, as a philosophy undergrad, which is a very particular, you know. And I think being a young woman in philosophy in that time, I think philosophy has changed a little bit, but then it was definitely, one person said, you know, it's sort of like argument as blood sport.
Okay.
So this quality of like very aggressive, you know, that's sort of like the highest honor you can give someone is to really attack their argument with your best weapons.
Okay. So rhetorical.
Yeah. And like a little bit vicious.
Yeah.
And I was someone who, being a young woman in that space, one of the things that I developed was this particular kind of intellectual sharpness so that I could win arguments. Taking this Wittgenstein class really, there was something transformative about it because he was someone who started with developing logical positivism in his initial early work. And then he really changed and he became really interested in what are the things that are, what are the things that are collectively agreed upon and have to be that way. So he has this late book that I don't know what it is in, I can't remember what it is in German, but in English it's Uncertainty. Where he talks about things that are, he calls them hinge propositions. So things that we hold stable, but they could be otherwise. So one of the examples he gives, this is before the people landed on the moon is a hinge proposition, something we all take for granted and assume is that no one has ever walked on the moon, right? So things that on which other things depend, but they can move, they can change. And for me, that that then proliferated out, or it became something that I became really interested in, all of the things that we can't say in words and why they matter, and why they matter politically. So then I wrote a master's thesis, and then did my dissertation work was about implicit understanding. So everything that you know that you can't necessarily put into words, but that matters enormously for the possibility of political transformation, personal transformation, and also collective transformation.
I associated now origin narrations.
Mm.
So your AIDS project and your story about you developed as a philosopher with Wittgenstein in mind, your story of origin, how do they shape us as people, as individuals, also as small collective entities?
I love that question. Thank you for that. Yeah, So one of the things that I think is so interesting about thinking about beginnings or about origin stories is that actually, of course, we're always in the middle of everything, right? So we only think of something as an origin or as a beginning when something has happened afterwards, that like there's been a process, there's been duration, there's been a continuity that then we name that is a beginning, right? So, you know, there's so many people that we read when we're 20 and they don't become a beginning that we cite as an origin. Or so many, you know, casual conversations we have that don't become friendships, right? But when they do, then we look back and we say that was the beginning, right? And when we look at anything, it's like this, right? That actually we're just making we're making an identification afterwards that something was our beginning. So, you know, in the AIDS activist project, this something that was really, you know, has like permanently transformed how I think about things, and especially about collective work, political work, activist work, was really understanding that these were people that, when they took up particular work, they were coming from having been in other activist milieu, and that when they did a project, a campaign, tried to win something, they really did relate to it as just a continual process, right? So something that was, that whether you win a particular campaign or you lose it, that win or loss is just the terrain for the next struggle or the next fight. I can give you an example that I always think of with that. Would that be good? Okay. So there was this, so this was in the late 80s and early 90s. So it was before effective antiretroviral drugs were available, which came in 1996. So this was a period where there were very few good treatments for HIV and AIDS, and people died of opportunistic infections, right? So they died of other things. One of the things that really killed a lot of people was a particular kind of pneumonia, PCP. And there was a drug that was very effective. So what would happen is often you would get this pneumonia, and most people would survive the first time, but if they got it multiple times, then it would kill them. So there was this drug, pentamidine, that was very, very effective if you aerosolized it and breathed it in, if you'd had PCP, this kind of pneumonia, before. In Canada, it was not approved for aerosol use. It was only approved for injection use. And it's a very harsh drug. It was really hard on people's veins and not effective, not very effective in injection. So people started working on trying to get access to the aerosolized version, which was not legal. And they did a lot of things. They were going across the border and getting drugs and having, you know, illicit administration for people who had had PCP once or twice before. But they also started working on getting the Canadian government to use a program that existed called the Emergency Drug Release Program to allow people to access this drug. So they worked on this for 4 years and they won it. So the Canadian government said yes. And this continues. This is still some of the things that if there are drugs that are showing efficacy, it's very complicated now too, right? Because we also need to hold a particular kind of critique of the pharmaceutical industry and the way that drug development, drug rollout is, you know, so but we can hold that in mind too. So they won this 4 years. And then right away, the next week in the meeting minutes, on the agenda is drug access. Because as soon as you have the program that allows the drug to be used, it's wildly expensive. People cannot afford it. So they won it. And right away, they started working on getting funding so that people who were low income could access it. And that's still the program that in Ontario people access when they need drugs that they can't afford. Mostly people have no idea that it was AIDS activists who won that fight.
And they won the argument.
They won it, yeah.
And this is your kind of work. I'm getting it now.
Yeah.
But let me say this. It's really intense how you're building up your argument because you always touch your body when you talk.
Yeah.
So is it kind of that your thinking is really connected to your body?
Yeah.
And how you think or empathize with other ones?
Yeah. And this is part of the, in my first book, which was about implicit understanding, I really think that our knowledge practices are always bodily and emotional and have these sort of deep common sense, you know, things. I have a friend, Natasha Myers, who wrote a beautiful, her PhD work was on the ways that scientists model their understanding through dance, through using their bodies. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true, you know, like that almost everyone I know who is a thinker also is a hand talker and, you know, and gestures and moves as they think. And this comes back to your question about relationships, right? So that when we're thinking about what we know and how we know it, you know, it's always something like that. And sometimes it's an activist movement that then shows us a way of thinking, right? So after learning, like thinking about this with AIDS activists, every beginning is just part of a process, right? Moving toward an end, but never stopping. I started seeing it everywhere, you know, that as long as we're alive, we're changing. And as long as we're changing, we're always doing it with others. So other beings offer us ways of understanding what's happening in our life, right? We be in conversation. I really love, you know, and doing podcasts, doing radio is such a example of this. There's a philosopher, Hans-Jörg Gadamer, who talked about the question, right? And I love this, right? Like that the space of the questions, having someone ask you a question opens something that you can't predict, right? And you can't generate that space yourself, right? It's only something that we offer to each other. It's so nice.
So there is no philosophy within one person.
I don't think so, yeah. It's always a relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it should be developed in a certain kind of space. Mm. And this space always has to be newly done every time, but it widens.
Yeah. And that's why...
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully it does. And that's why that's sort of my early paradigm of being, you know, a young person studying philosophy and sort of participating in philosophy as blood sport, right, is such a... It's so sad. It's such an offense to that possibility of doing something together, right? Thinking together.
And do we have this blood sport today as well? This kind of argument. I was a friend sent me that video of this Jordan guy in Canada,
Jordan Peterson.
Yes, yeah. And he's really aggressive all the time. Yeah. He wants to win every argument. And sometimes I think he hasn't got really, really the purpose or the grounding for it or the practice.
That's right.
But he wants to win the argument. This is a kind of vicious process as well. And lots of young men are following him like he's the new Jesus or whatever. What do you think of these kind of, because he demands for himself, he's not a philosopher, but he's a psychologist, isn't he?
I mean, yes, he has a degree in psychology. And he was appointed as a psychologist. I don't, you know, and I think this question of kind of the new sophistry, right? So that, as you're pointing out, this practice that has no content, right? It's just a practice of arguing in a particular way. Mm-hmm. Except it does have this, it does have a content of tending toward a way of being in the world that is, you know, it's profoundly dominative. It's aggressive. It's invested in a particular kind of hierarchy and a particular kind of imagined past, right? When men were men and women, women. And it's also so interesting. I've written a little bit about, I'm really interested in food and the question of food as a relationship. And I've written a little bit about Jordan Peterson and his daughter. Both are participating in this meat-only practice of you know, meat and salt and
it's
water.
It's a kind of a purity.
It's a purity practice, yeah. And what's so interesting about it, when you really look at, I've spent a lot of time sort of in these carnivory Facebooks and also looking at like what Peterson and his daughter, Michaela Peterson, who is a sort of internet celebrity in her own right, they really, what's fascinating about it is that they articulate their need to have a meat-only diet in terms that I read as they're experiencing really profound disability and they're trying to personally manage it, right? So they really talk about having like profound mental health challenges, Michaela Peterson talks about having this sort of autoimmune condition that meant that she has a physical reaction to most kinds of foods. So it's the concentration of this, you know, we could say neoliberal, but a belief that when you're afflicted by suffering, when you have a difficult time, you just have to take care of it yourself because no one is going to help you. You're alone.
So the Gespräch is done.
Yeah.
You're back on your own.
Yeah.
There is no community. There's no social effectiveness.
Yeah. And no one deserves
And thinking
help.
Has died.
Yeah. Thinking has died then because it's out of relation, right? So it's, you know, we can see that move or that quality any of the times when people despair of collectivity, right? Yeah. And I think it comes together with the kind of, I don't want to just think about it as an internet imperative, but this sort of sense of that everyone should have an opinion all the time and hold it strongly. You know, that it's hard actually for us to say, I don't know. You know, I don't know how we should do this, right?
Particularly as academic.
Yeah.
You don't have to. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of a, if you say, I don't know, you're done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're supposed to be certain all the time.
Certain. Yes. Yeah. That's its certainty.
Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, coming back to Wittgenstein, that there's all these things we can only be certain of if we have trustworthy others who are reference points for us because we can't know everything. You know, over the last 10 years, the main thing that I've been interested in is, how do we resist purity politics, right? So for me, purity politics are this, it's a bunch of things, but one of the things is what I was just talking about. So this belief that there's big systemic problems, you're involved in a world that makes you sick, and you are morally responsible to take care of yourself and individually manage it, right? So you should, you know, eat organic, your water, you know, do all of these things. So it's this kind of retreat to the individual. So that's a kind of purity politics that's based on you take care of yourself and actually like purify your own personal world and there's something wrong with you if you can't hold it together. But then the other one that we see is really this move toward when the world is incredibly complicated and impossible to understand, and the problems we face are so enormous that we cannot personally solve them. Like what happens, right? And one of the things that tends to happen is that people try to just figure out what the right side to be on is, you know? And often that is saying that someone else isn't doing it right. So the gesture of critique, of saying, you know, you have the wrong view about Palestine, or you are a monster because you are masking, or you're a monster because you're not masking, that sort of posture is one where in decrying the other and making them wrong, you're securing yourself as pure, right? Like you're safe from critique. But of course, this operation, this mechanism, what it does is it moves to just push people out and out and out. So we end up with sort of just smaller and smaller enclaves of the people who are like ideologically correct, you know, have never fucked up, are not, you know, not making any mistakes. They have the right language. They say the right thing at the right time. And of course, this is none of us, right? If we follow that as our political program, we just end up with, tiny people in tiny bubbles. But the scale and scope of problems we face, we need, you know, hundreds of millions of really imperfect people working together on things. So for me, the interesting kind of relationship isn't the kind of dyadic or the small bubble relationship. It's the relationships where we hold the possibility for mistake and for being wrong, and where actually it's through being together through those mistakes and those difficulties that we get better, more adequate, kinder knowledge that allows more of us to get on together. So that sounds kind of idealistic, I think.
Yeah. And yeah. I was thinking about, do you develop this room as an academic room in your faculty as well?
Yeah.
And can you do this? Is this a room where we can have, because if we are in contact with this social media, there's always the gesture, the pointing to ourselves with phones and cameras.
Yeah.
So that an ideal or purity is already in place.
Yeah.
So let loose and be kind of imperfect. That's the base of all.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and in academics, you're right. We're not encouraged this space of imperfection and this space of partiality and being unsure. I think that some of the most powerful, the most interesting places I experience these possibilities are in the classroom, where it's simultaneously that as the professor, right, as the instructor, I know things, right? I'm there to teach them. But also, it's a space of encounter, and it's a space where I don't have mastery, you know, and my students have also insight and things to offer one another, and me, you know. And so I feel like one of the most valuable things we do in the academy is create the pedagogical space, which simultaneously acknowledges that people have things to teach each other, right? It's not that we just sort of all are the same, that it would be a failure for me as a teacher to go into a classroom and say to the students, let's just have this be about what you know already, right? That would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it would also be ridiculous for me to go into the classroom and say, I am the only one in this classroom who knows anything useful, right? Instead, we have this space where we collectively work on something from different positions. So both in academic work and in activist work, actually, I take this concept from a wonderful lawyer and activist and professor, Dean Spade. He doesn't remember saying this, but I I remember him saying it, so I always cite him when I use it. So, yeah. I've talked to him about it, and he says, I don't remember saying that.
Okay.
I remember him saying that he was very interested in collective epistemic privilege. So epistemic, how we know something, what we know, what our standards are for taking people's testimony seriously. And when we have individual epistemic privilege, we would say, you know, I would say, well, I defer to someone, to you, on the matter of Vienna, because you know Vienna and I don't know Vienna. You know it better than I do, right? I would give you epistemic authority as a testifier about Vienna. You know, if I was like, what's that siren?
Yeah.
You know, you would be able to say like, oh, that's
ambulance.
Yeah, that's an ambulance siren. Well, it's an unusual sound. I haven't. Yeah. But if we're looking at something like what should happen in this department, or what should we do about climate change?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no individual person who we should accord epistemic privilege to. That would be too much pressure on a person. And also, we know that knowledge is partial, so they would not be able to tell us, right? The best way for us to know something is to know it together. And to have mechanisms for being able to figure out in this partial, imperfect world, which direction shall we take, you know? And how will we know that it's a good direction to go?
Do you associate these purity matters also with fascism? Are they kind of originated in fascism as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So in my context, this is partially, you know, sort of fascism as we know it, right? But also in the North American context, it's really stitched together with a different kind of eugenic practice, a different kind of racial practice, a different kind of racial purity practice.
Yeah.
But absolutely, you know, shared ideological foundations and moves. And so that's, I think, one of the reasons why, as someone on the left, I'm so vehemently critical of left purity practices.
All right.
You know, because I think that tendency and that mode is always going to bend toward authoritarianism and a particular kind of collective social practice that is not open and available to surprise. Right, that doesn't offer us something that we can't already predict. And, you know, we really are, I think, in this world where what we need is something that we cannot currently predict, because the only things that capitalism predicts are more of the same, right?
It has to be more.
It has to be more, exactly as it is, yeah. And we know where that's leading us.
Yeah.
So we need something that even we who are imagining otherwise, we can't imagine alone. And we need something that can surprise the world, actually, right? Like, and to have that be a practice, process, and a way of being, right? That is unpredicted current conditions.
My impression is always that these engagements are always on particular and small groups.
Mm.
How do we get the majority?
Yeah.
How do we involve them in these processes? How do we get them out of a consumed world?
One of the things that I believe really deeply is that everyone cares about the world.
Interesting.
And that the thing that gets in the way of people caring about it together, caring about it collectively, is that we've become convinced that it's useless, or that we're supposed to just personally do it ourselves. Like, so I think that there's a very small minority of people who actually want to continue destroying the world. And there's a very large number of people who would like the world to continue and for people and beings in it to be flourishing. And so the gap is just, I think that's tremendously good news.
Okay.
Because if we had a whole world where everyone was just like, I don't care if all of the birds die. I don't care if all of the water is poisoned. I don't care if anyone can breathe, you know? That would be a much grimmer world to be in, much more difficult. A world in which people are like, I am desperately afraid that, you know, I am desperately afraid that the Danube will die. I want everyone to have air to breathe, right? Like all of these things that are cheesy to say, but, you know, I want those things. I just don't have any idea how to get there. You know, I recycle, or I compost, I do, you know, so the gap isn't getting people to care about things. It's figuring out how do people connect with each other and with bigger projects and actually do something that's strategic.
But we had the illusion that social media could do this.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Some of the time it does, but it's, so I think that's really the question is like, if we only stay in the place where we're going to learn more, scroll and express, that's a particular bubble, right? So it has to be that we take the spaces where social media gives people a consciousness of something, an awareness of something, and there needs to be a little bit more, and here's how you do something that isn't just writing another post or writing a letter, right? So it really is about education a little bit, you know, and looking at like, well, what has changed the world in the past? And you have these reference points, yeah, right? There are places where people have come together, ordinary people. And this is so important to me, right? It's not usually intellectuals and academics who have figured out, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to say no. We're going to say no to this airport. We're going to say no. We're going to say no to building condos on the island in the Danube, you know, and instead we're going to have that be as open a place as possible. You know, but people have done that because they want spaces that are not commodified. They want spaces to gather. So there's just so much of that, that if we tell those histories, on Monday, I was with these wonderful people who are doing this Labau Listening Comprehensive Collective, which is just going and listening to the Labau floodplain and sort of learning about what is the impulse to have there be a floodplain here where there was one, right? You know, and it's so interesting to learn about these things. How have people said, I want this to still exist. I want to visit these birds. As soon as you start really looking at that, you say, oh, in order for these birds to still come here, actually, we need to address all these other things. But everyone has something that they care for, right? And it turns out any of those things are actually connected to the very biggest world systems that exist. Mm. They are, right? It's just making that connection.
Guessing what a kind of origin story you tell yourself, I will say it's a kind of this micro story, isn't it?
Mm. But it's the micro story where anything we look at is just it's not a fractal exactly, but nothing is disconnected, right? So anything we care about is connected to these bigger things. So like any micro is part of a world. And it's just resisting the lie that any micro is its own little bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and that's hard to do. I get it. That's hard to do.
Questions as well, because we are changing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
When you were a student of philosophy, what was your origin story that you depend on or was really motivating for you?
Yeah, this is a complicated question, actually, because I'm also like writing and thinking about it now. So I grew up in a Buddhist community. My parents were hippie dropout, and so I grew up meditating. And in the form of Buddhism that I practiced, which was based on compassion, one of the vows that you take is a vow to basically to save all beings, to benefit to all beings, and to end the suffering of all beings before you end your own suffering. And this is an impossible vow to take, right? It's not possible. But the paradox of that, committing to something that you know you cannot accomplish, that has always been one of my core motivators. So much of my life, I really, everything I did was based on this, like, in this context, how am I easing suffering? How am I trying to be of benefit? And then 4 or 5 years ago, my community started having enormous scandals about abuse by my main teacher. So it's very irritating to have a Buddhist spiritual crisis, because it turns out that Buddhism is very useful for saying, oh, did you rely on something that's actually falling apart? So now sometimes I'm like revisiting a lot of my origin stories, because I wouldn't, before this experience of really reconsidering everything I think about Buddhism and meditation and transformation, I wouldn't have said that my main sort of identity was being a Buddhist. But then when I have had that fall apart, it turns out that it was really key. So now I don't know. And I'm letting it sort of be like...
messy?
Uncertain, right? So I haven't...
Uncertain.
Yeah, I haven't like repudiated, you know, everything about that whole life. But I just don't know. I don't know what to do with it.
So interesting next book, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
now I've gone back. Now it's so predictable. It's like I have been reading existentialists again, like I was a 20-year-old.
Yeah.
And I'm writing about existentialism and anarchism.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But why predictable? Could be something totally.
I mean, it's fine. And maybe I'm being too hard on myself that way, but I was just telling a friend yesterday that I went back and reread my copy of Being and Nothingness. I last read when I was 20 as a philosophy grad, and it's amazing to me. I read the whole thing, like it's all annotated. I don't think I have time for that now, you know, do it. But no, I mean, I think, so there's something about coming back to a philosophical orientation that was really important when you were young, just a person, you know, and there's like a sweetness there. And also it is very helpful to be like, I mean, I do genuinely feel in this moment where we are facing existential questions, right? Like, and when you look back at the history of the tradition, the Western philosophical tradition, they too were saying, all right, you know, if we recognize that humans have freedom and choose, right? Like make choices about what kinds of beings we're going to be. They were writing in the wake of the Holocaust in relation to gender oppression, in relation to colonialism, you know, so Fanon and Beauvoir and Sartre and Richard Wright, they were, you know, they were saying like, what do we do with the fact that given infinite freedom to choose how to be, what kinds of beings to be, humans commit atrocities against each other, right? How do we actually reckon with that and with the idea that we could do something otherwise? So I've been moved by that and then trying to amplify in the existentialist tradition, not the sort of individual part, like the being the sort of like the blazing brand that, you know, the torch that does its own thing. But instead that question of, Beauvoir says, only humans oppress other humans, right? Like the weather does not oppress us. It's something that happens, right? But we steal freedom from one another. And she says, therefore we have to open freedom to one another. And that's like very compelling and moving. But actually she doesn't talk very precisely about how we open freedom to one another. So I'm trying to do that. It's very arrogant, but I'm working on it.
Excellent ending. I think I thank you very much. This was super insight in your development and your thinking. Thanks very much, Alexis.
Well, this was a really precious conversation for me. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Signation unseres Podcasts stammt von Sebastian Klingowski. Wissenschaftliche Beratung erfahren wir durch Karin Harasser, Andreas Gerlach und Julia Burg-Kaminski. Für die Öffentlichkeitsarbeit zuständig ist Stefanie Obermeier. Technische Unterstützung Max Ott.
In der Produktion unterstützen mich Christina Hügler, Daniela Losinitzky und Andreas Katan. Die Konzeption des Kulturdenken-Podcasts stammt von Alexander Martosch und mir, Martin Gasteiner. Sie finden den Podcast in Ihrer bevorzugten Podcast-Plattform. Wir freuen uns über Ihre Meinung, Kommentare und Fragen und auch Ihre Bewertungen. Auf Wiederhören in der Episode 5.